Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with peace and justice activist Kathy Kelly. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe world-renowned playwright, author of The Vagina Monologues, founder of V-Day, Eve Ensler. Her new book of monologues is called I Am an Emotional Creature, The Secret Life of Girls Around the World, and it will be performed here in Santa Fe this Saturday night, February 20th, at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. Great to have you back on the show.
Thrilled to be back.
So this is a new work, and it's a series of monologues expressing the lives of girls, many of them adolescent girls, and these voices come from all over the world. How did you gather these stories? Are they true stories, based on true stories?
Well, the way I work, and particularly with this book, is they're all fictional monologues and pieces, but they're based on elements of truth, whether I found them in articles or books or interviews or I heard about something, you know. So they're based on reality and then turned into fiction.
They cover such a wide range of topics, and we'll talk about some of them, but one of them that really stuck in my mind was the story was from Iran, and it was about a girl whose parents gave her, for her 16th birthday, something which she didn't want at all, which was a nose job. She went into a horrible state of sadness because before she'd been a clown, and now she was merely a pretty girl.
Right, exactly. She'd been a really funny person, and her nose had really given her this character and permission to be daring and mischievous and funny and outrageous. And then when her nose got fixed, she was suddenly a princess, which she had no desire to be.
What, did that come from reality? I have to ask.
Well, actually, it is loosely based on a real story, and I've also interviewed a whole bunch of girls from Tehran who have had nose jobs, and it's kind of... In the middle class, there's a kind of mandate, you know, a great pressure to fix your nose. But as there is in other cultures.
Right, right. So you're taking on in this book, as you always do, this whole huge range of topics. And you hit on eating disorders and relationships with family and boyfriends and girlfriends and pregnancy. And then the real heavy stuff like the sex trade and slavery and war and so much else. And you've been working with this material for a long time and more than most of the rest of us. Was there anything that you came across in doing this new work that surprised you?
I think the kind of thematic conclusions didn't necessarily surprise me, but disturbed me. I think that across the planet, what I talk about in the introduction is there is this mandate, this cultural, religious, familial mandate for girls to please in one way or another in all places and villages and towns and cities across the planet. And that mandate to please is robbing girls to a large degree of their own authentic, original choices and desires. And I think what was disturbing is to see how that gets played out from culture to culture, even though it appears to be different, is in fact the underpinnings of the same dynamic.
You know, it's funny because many women who were raised before the most recent women's movement have struggled with this. You have, I have. And then to see that teenage girls are still struggling with the same thing, do you see that there's been any progress since we were young, since these girls' mothers were being raised to please rather than to question?
I think there are pockets of change. You know, I think where girls were brought up to feel empowered and feel a right to their destinies and feel, you know, that they needed to be educated and were supported in being educated, yes, there's definitely change. I will say, though, I don't think we've yet reached a point in the world where girls are born happy to be girls, where that's a celebration. I think it's still that you make the best of that predicament, as opposed to being thrilled that you're born a girl.
Very interesting. I can't help but wonder whether there is somewhere, or if you've seen someplace, where girls and teenage girls are doing well. They feel safe. They feel happy, empowered. Have you seen a model of what that looks like culturally anywhere?
Well, I certainly have seen in various places throughout the world where people have feminist mothers and daughters are brought up to know that they have a right to challenge stereotypes and a right to challenge everybody's demands on them. You know, there are certainly girls. And look, we know that many more girls are in colleges and are rising to the tops of academia. That's definitely happening. And I actually can tell you, for example, like in our safe house in Kenya, where girls have run away and fled FGM and are being educated, going to school, not being forced into marriage, those girls are really empowered, as are girls in various circumstances where they've overcome various obstacles, But at the same time, you can look around the world and see, for example, this cultural mandate in the West to be skinny, and I don't think that's gotten less. I think it's gotten worse. I think many girls have eating disorders. Many girls, this image of Barbie has not gone away. There are 1 billion Barbies in the world. They're sold, one Barbie sold every 3 seconds. So that hasn't changed, right? And those Barbies are getting exported around the world. And that image of what girls are supposed to be is still the dominant image of what girls are supposed to be. The statistics of girls, for example, in America, how many girls are in relationships with boys where they get beaten or punched or kicked. I think it's something like 1 out of 5 girls are in abusive relationships. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
You described both in the book and just now girls escaping FGM, female genital mutilation, and becoming empowered. Do you see that phenomenon of girls, when they have to overcome something, becoming that much stronger and happier for the adversity that they faced?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things I hope the book is about is, I think it's looking at girls in various stages of meeting their obstacles. Some girls are surrendering, some girls are resisting, and some girls are triumphing, And I think if you look at girls, for example, a lot of girls that I've met, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the worst atrocities on the planet are happening to women and their bodies in the name of this economic war, which is essentially being fought on the bodies of women for control of minerals in eastern Congo. I've interviewed, and I've talked to and I've witnessed girls who, for example, have been through horrible rapes and horrible atrocities, but their surviving that has given them enormous strength and enormous resiliency to transform their lives and the lives of their families. And it's that syndrome we talked about, or that incredible idea that of turning pain to power, and of vagina warriors, women who have been through really, really painful, difficult violence, and rather than succumbing to it, they actually grieve it and then transform their lives and devote their lives to making sure it doesn't happen to other girls and women. So we certainly see that across the planet. Girls who have overcome eating disorders, girls who have broken through in sports and been able to overcome the kind of intersection of race and poverty and sexism, those girls are fierce. So I think both things are simultaneously true.
There was a monologue in the book, and that will be performed on Saturday night, of a girl who was on vacation and at a lake and gets basically kidnapped and put in sexual slavery and escapes after a couple of years. And it's a kind of how-to guide to not succumbing emotionally to this horrible situation that she was in. And I was wondering, let's say you've got a suburban girl reading this. Do you see girls transforming those really, really bad things and kind of adapting those lessons to their own lives?
Oh, I think so. I actually witnessed a school called Archer School in L.A. with the girls reading those pieces the other night. And it was amazing to me to see how close those pieces resonated to those girls. And I think there are lessons to be had in everybody's story, whether it's how you maintain yourself, how you don't, I think sometimes with in situations where girls get sexually abused or raped or we're told afterwards that we're finished for life and that once you've been raped or been abused, you're done, and they've taken away your voice and your body. And in fact, what that girl says in the piece is, you know, no one can take your spirit away from you if you don't give it to them. You know, that's your choice. So I think that's a lesson you could learn in any situation. You can be through the worst of times, but your spirit's yours. Your spirit, you determine your spirit. And I think that's crucial for girls who go through various obstacles and various situations so that they know that, you know, we're cats. We have lives. You know, we have lots of lives. And we're transformable.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. It's interesting, too, because at the beginning there's a monologue set in some suburb where a girl is in high school and is suffering from that whole hierarchy of popularity and prettiness and perfection. And I was thinking, you know, some of these girls who are in child labor or sexual slavery or war would probably give anything to have that girl's life. And then that girl who has the perfect life has this unfulfillable expectation of perfection and is suffering in her own way.
Well, that's the thing I hope about the book. You know, everybody's suffering is a relative, isn't it? And I think often I hear people, look, you know, being in the midst of war and being in the midst of atrocities is one thing. And obviously being held as a sex slave is, but I think that, you know, sometimes I look at something like female genital mutilation, which is a terrible tradition, but I've seen it when the tradition ends. And for the African girls who are, you know, have been, you know, threatened with that tradition, when it's over, they're free. They go on and they move forward in life because, for example, all that cellular programming to be skinny and to look a certain way and to wear a certain thing and to, hasn't been shot into them. So they have once the tradition's over, they have a certain freedom that girls in the West will never have. So I think rather than compare people's difficulties, I think if we look at them on one global continuum where we see that there are cultural mandates in every culture saying to girls for you to please in one way or another and for you to serve and for you to give up your authentic self, and what, then it becomes a global story that we can all begin to appreciate.
We've talked about female genital mutilation in Africa and beyond, and you, the last time I heard you speak, or one of the last times I heard you speak, you said, basically, we need a certain amount of money and 10 years for this to be done. And I thought, wow, that's an actual finite, achievable goal. How is that going?
I think it's going very well. I mean, look, there are many NGOs and many groups doing incredibly good work on female genital mutilation around the world and having huge successes. I can speak of our program in Kenya where Agnes Pariyo, who was cut as a young woman, started a program 7 years ago with V-Day support, and she's now the director of V-Day in Kenya, as a matter of fact, and where she opened a house to stop female genital mutilation where girls can flee, where girls are supported to go to school, where they're not forced into marriage. And she, you know, she has rescued hundreds and hundreds of girls from being cut, and they are now going to school, and they're having incredibly good lives. And when we were there in August, we were with her because she's opened a second house now in another village. And we could, you know, we created with her. She really envisioned a 10-year plan where she could see the end of female genital mutilation in Maasailand in 10 years. And I actually think it's very possible. I think once the tradition changes and once the, you know, and you have to be in the tradition to change it. I don't think people from the outside have any business going in to change people's traditions. But Agnes is Maasai and she was cut, and she is of the world, and she knows how to, you know, support the traditions and change them at the same time. And I think we are seeing hugely good results. That's not to say we don't have a lot of work to do, but I think there's real possibility of seeing FGM end.
One thing that comes up in the book and in the theater work is this huge, giant gap between how an adolescent girl feels about male attention directed toward her and how the males feel who are giving her that attention. And that brings up this whole question of how you see your work in terms of not only empowering females, but educating males as to what the female experience is.
Well, you know, one of the things I've been very excited about this book, I was just on radio out here in San Francisco, and how many men called in, and it's been happening everywhere I've been going. You know, I like to think that all of us have the girl cell in us, and that it you know, or a group of girl cells, which are these cells which are compassionate and empathetic and vulnerable and intuitive and wildly compassionate. And it was interesting when I was in India recently. I did this talk at TED India about the girl cell, and I was so moved by how many men came up to me afterwards to thank me for honoring the girl inside them and to say how hard it is to live in the world, you know, and be emotional and be open and be vulnerable and be lost and be... And I think, in a way, I hope this new work is a call to the girl in everyone and a call to the girl part in all of us, which is emotional, which is passionate, which is authentic, which is a little revolutionary, which is resistant.
One of the things that really surprised me in the book, you have a series of what are called girl facts sprinkled throughout the book, and one of them is that 40% of the world's child soldiers are girls.
Right.
I almost fell off my chair.
Yeah. Well, also, and 40% of those girl soldiers, a good part of them are being they're essentially sex slaves. You know, a large part of what girl soldiers do is serve other soldiers
right.
as slaves.
And then they're put on the front lines, or they're put on cooking duty. So it's
exactly. Either one and both.
Right. Shocking. And because, of course, we hear, you know, from time to time about child soldiers, and this is a story that has yet to be told, and I hope it is told a lot more. I'll be looking for it. You and I have talked on this program before, and one of the things that I was wondering, and this is a personal question, I don't know if you want to answer it, but you take on these huge issues that are too difficult for most people to even look at for more than 15 minutes, much less work with. How did you cultivate the strength that you have to do this work so intensely and for so long?
You know, I think we have this illusion, and I certainly had it for some of my life, that if we don't look at things and we don't address things, that we're actually being protected from them. But in fact, my life experience has been that when I deny things and I push them out and I try to shut them down, they begin to absorb more and more of my energy, just keeping them away from me. I think when you open yourself to the difficulties and the tragedies and the atrocities that exist, yes, it's painful. And I'm not saying I don't have days where I'm, you know, completely overwhelmed by what I'm witnessing and hearing. And so I have days where I grieve, you know. But when you grieve and you feel, you actually are able to pass through things to get to the next place. When you resist and deny things, you don't get through. And it begins, that denial and resistance begins to consume a great deal of energy. So I think what I've learned is that as long as I can cry, as long as I can grieve, as long as I can feel what's going on, I have a way of actually passing through it and getting stronger and being more present for people. You know?
Yeah. We're talking to Eve Ensler. The work is called I Am an Emotional Creature. And I have to admit, my first reaction when I saw the book was, now, wait a minute, isn't that a stereotype about females that's been used against us? And I wondered
yes.
why you... Yeah.
Which is the point.
I
think we've all been taught to be apologetic and to feel bad about being emotional. And what my whole life I was told I was too intense, too dramatic, too emotional, too extreme, too. And so much of my life I felt guilty or bad about it. And I think what I've really come to realize as an activist, certainly, is you cannot bring about social change unless you have a certain degree of passion and emotion. It's impossible. And I'm not saying we should just be crazy emotional people, you know, people without any intellect and without any intelligence connected to it. But I am saying that I think we should stop apologizing for being emotional. And we should stop seeing it as something less than and something that it's fuel. It's fuel. And I think How do you get through things? You allow whatever that fuel is to connect you to something so you can become devoted and you can become committed. And it's not a head thing that allows you to keep going. It just isn't.
And also, I mean, I think it brings out that kind of false polarity of intellect and emotion, which I think most women, when they think about it, realize is not a total polarity in the first place, that those things don't have to be separate and aren't separate.
Exactly. And I think part of it is that we're told, like, how many times have I been told in my life, you're being too emotional or you're being too intense? And I really, in some ways, don't even know what that means, except for that you're being too alive about something and you care too much about something. And really, we are in very difficult straits as human beings. If we don't care an awful lot in the next few years, I don't really know how we're going to keep going. So I hope the book is a call to people's greatest passion to overcome the things that we are presently facing.
Now, this book and work of theater, set of monologues, I Am an Emotional Creature, The Secret Life of Girls Around the World, will be performed here in Santa Fe on Saturday night, and you've opened in New York and Los Angeles. Tell us about those performances.
Well, it's just been very, very exciting because we allowed and invited 14 pilot sites this year to do really readings, stage readings of the work, just so we could just begin to get a feel for what the work is and how people would, play it and what monologues people would choose. And it's been just fabulous. And, it premiered in India and Mumbai with a fantastic group of women, young women who performed it. And then Rosaria Dawson just did a just gorgeous, gorgeous reading in New York with a wild cross-section of girls there. And I have to say, it was a fantastic reading. And then I just saw a production at Archer School in L.A., and now we're coming to Santa Fe, and there's one being done by Indian girls in South Dakota, another production in Arizona, and I think there's a production in Kenya and in former Yugoslavia. And I think what is thrilling about it is just to begin to try the work out and see what works, see what doesn't, see what pieces go together, because I'm just beginning to find the play. This is a book of monologues, and then I'll carve it and shape it into a dramatic work. And then we'll do a commercial production of it. But it's been so much fun to go and see what each group comes up with and how they interpret the monologues and what they do with it.
Oh, so it's really a work in progress, and through these works, including the Santa Fe, it will come together into something new.
Oh, yes, exactly. This is just the book. It is not a play yet. And I'm just beginning to do the weaving and the constructing of it into a play.
Very interesting. How did you, or are you still in the process of, I mean, you are a woman old enough to be most of these girls' mother, perhaps a few of their grandmother, find the voice that is the authentic voice to today's girls. Are you helping? Are they helping to do that? How's that? How does that work?
Well, I think I'm still 15, really, truly. I don't think I ever grew much past that. I think if I were really honest with myself, like, that is my truest voice. But, I've also spent a lot of time with girls over the last year listening, hopefully paying attention, heeding. I've got a 13-year-old granddaughter. I'm around girls a lot. And I think one of the most exciting things about this project was trying to inhabit those voices and trying to inhabit those girls and feel what they were feeling. So, I could honor their world and pay attention to their world and celebrate their world.
So do we have a teenage cast here in Santa Fe?
Oh, you do. You have a wonderful teenage cast there, and I hear they're amazing. Amazing.
Well, this is happening on Saturday night, February 20th. I Am an Emotional Creature, The Secret Life of Girls Around the World. The book came out last week. The performance is this Saturday night at the Lensic. The telephone number over there is 505-988-1234. Eve Ensler is world-renowned playwright, author of The Vagina Monologues, and this new book, founder of V-Day, which is on the web at vday.org. And there's also a new website called v-girls.org, vgirls.org. Eve, thank you so much for being with us on
thank
the Radio
you.
Cafe.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to talk to you. Love your show.
She's a rebel. She's a saint. She's the salt of the earth. And she's dangerous. She's a rebel. Vigilante. Missing link on the break of the church. She's a rebel. She's a saint. She's the salt of the earth. And she's dangerous. She's a rebel. Vigilante. Missing link on the break of the church. She's a rebel. She's a rebel.
I'm happy now to welcome Kathy Kelly. She is a peace and justice activist. She's co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness and Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And she will be at the Unitarian Church in Santa Fe tonight, Wednesday at 7 o'clock, co-sponsored by Pax Christi and Veterans for Peace. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, hello, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you back. And your work in nonviolence and your work really illuminating what the American military machine is doing, you could say takes a kind of follow the money approach. When great amounts of money is being spent in Iraq, you were there. Where is your Iraq work today?
Well, we didn't want to walk away from people who had given us so much hospitality in Iraq. We stayed in Iraq during the shock and awe bombing and tried to maintain a presence there for a good year and a half after that. And then it became really impossible to remain without bringing trouble to people because Westerners were held in such suspicion and sometimes antagonism. And actually, I could walk down the street where I live in Chicago and be in touch with Iraqis who have had to abandon their homes, flee their security, whatever they had before the invasion and occupation. And of course, some had terrible memories of life under Saddam Hussein as well, but many of them have been quite traumatized and displaced, landing in generally low-income areas of cities in the United States and trying to put their lives together. And there are people in the communities across the United States who are, you know, extending a helping hand, but really there's never enough. You can't follow the money and find that it's landing in the agencies or amongst the community groups that are trying to help the people that have been so uprooted, really, because of invasion and occupation. We also, though, realize that the United States military has gone on to attack Pakistan, which we're not at war with, but particularly in the last 2 months, the drone attacks in Pakistan and the United States' insistence that the Pakistani government wage bombing raids and artillery attacks against various places considered to be, they say, Taliban strongholds in Pakistan have caused many people to be displaced. There were 2 million displaced within 10 days when I was in Pakistan in this past spring. I suppose, you know, Joseph Stiglitz, he's a Nobel Prize-winning economist. And he, along with Linda Bilmes from Harvard University, has calculated that the cost of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is $3 trillion. And that would come out to $1,000 per person in the United States, so per trillion. So 1,000 per trillion, and the cost is actually conservatively $3 trillion. So that's $3,000 per person. And if you consider an extended family, maybe, you know, you might have three or four members of your extended family, then you're talking about a $12,000 expenditure. And that gets to be quite a lot for each person in the United States for these wars. What are we benefiting from? What are we getting? And is our security perhaps even being jeopardized because of the United States bombing and destruction of other people's homes in other parts of the world?
Tell us what you did and what you saw in Pakistan.
Well, we went to be as close as possible to people who had borne the consequences of the drone attacks, the unmanned aerial vehicles that were firing Hellfire missiles and dropping 500-pound bombs into places where there was a suspect who, you know, would never get the privilege of a trial or due process of any sort. And in fact, a lot of times they'd have the wrong spot and It took 14 attempts to kill Betuel Mesud, and then on the 15th they did kill him, but the 14 previous attempts had been, you know, aimed at people that were oftentimes deemed to be innocent civilians by the Pakistani government. So when we got there, we realized that actually the larger story was that within 10 days, 2 million people had become refugees, having been told by the Pakistani military, okay, the curfew is going to lift for 4 hours. You better run for your lives, you know, grab your family. People were literally carrying their grandmothers on their backs, you know, pregnant women racing away. One woman gave birth to a child on the road. Families told us about passing many dead bodies and trying to dig mass graves on their way out of town. So it was a very panicked situation, and we went to visit people who certainly didn't all have the same view. Some were so angry at the Taliban that they hoped that the Taliban fighters would be completely removed. Others weren't talking at all about whether or not they'd had any contact with the Taliban, and others were just so very, very alarmed and concerned because they were close to destitution anyway. And, you know, what if the cow thirsted to death or starved, or what if they had crops that would just be withered by the time they'd get back to their homes? And this, of course, did happen. So there's a tremendous, tremendous impoverishment and need for every kind of assistance in terms of Pakistan's development. But there's also an anxiety that if they get tied in as a client state of the United States, maybe that assistance won't go in the directions that would most benefit the neediest. Meanwhile, the Taliban finds that to be very fertile recruitment ground. You know, you can kind of do a Robin Hood number and say, hey, Islam doesn't want you to live this way. You don't want to live this way. Band with us and we'll scare these moneylenders and landowners right out of town. And so it's a complicated thing, but I think poverty is something that the United States ought to be looking at when it views Pakistan and Afghanistan. And instead, we're going to spend $1 million per soldier per year in Afghanistan.
The numbers are staggering, and as we've, it's funny, I just watched the film, I didn't see it when it came out, but I saw it just the other day, Charlie Wilson's War, and it was yet another example, including what we are continuing to live through, of the U.S. being very good at violence and really bad at the humanitarian things in those very same countries, both during and after conflicts.
Well, it seems that we have so much to learn from what happened to the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union pretty well bankrupted its country on trying to maintain a military dominance in Afghanistan. And, I mean, they were somewhat in proximity in terms of geography. I mean, here we are on the other side of the world. It costs $400 to get 1 gallon of gasoline from the United States to Afghanistan. And you might think, well, wait a minute, that's impossible. But by the time they pay various fighters not to shoot at the convoys and transport the gasoline over to Pakistan and up through Pakistan and across the Khyber Pass and then into various parts of Afghanistan, that's what the Congressional Research Service has calculated is the price for 1 gallon of gasoline that would go in either an airborne vehicle or a land vehicle. And every soldier uses about 22 gallons of gasoline. Well, meanwhile, you've got people who are desperately poor, women who are, you know, weaving rugs all day long, trying to get enough income to feed their children if they're, if they've been widowed or if the man in the house is away fighting with the military. And who's going to take care of the children in the daytime? You know, little ones tend to get restless and run around, and women are so desperate they give opium to the children, barbiturates to the children. I mean, these are situations of high desperation, stunted growth, impure water. 30% of the people have no access to clean water. There are 10,000 villages in Afghanistan. And, you know, the idea that the United States would be able somehow to go into all of those villages and prevent the Taliban from taking hold, you know, we might be able to go into the village of Marja tomorrow, and the United States would say, okay, we'll hold this village, but the Taliban are long gone, and they've gone to the next village or town. And so it's a kind of a preposterous idea that the United States is going to do what the Soviet Union wasn't able to do. But somebody's benefiting from this war, some companies and corporations undoubtedly are benefiting them. You know, Blackwater and Halliburton. Well, Blackwater changed his name to Z, and Boeing and General Electric, General Dynamics, Martin Marietta, Lockheed. These are the big defense and security companies. But I don't think it benefits the United States people. We need some Congress people and some senators who will say, hey, I'm going to get out ahead of the curve and start, you know, teaching people about this, like Chuck Hagel did with regard to Iraq, and gain the respect of both progressives and, you know, people that are independent thinkers.
The stories that you tell from the ground, whether it be in Iraq or in Pakistan, are stories that are very important to appeal just basically to the humanitarian instincts of ordinary Americans. Are you able to get those stories out? They certainly do not seem to find their way into the mainstream media most of the time.
Well, sometimes you have to look to other media. Ajaz Frost Press told a story that I often tell audiences about a man who was a brigadier artillery officer in the Afghan army. He lived in the province of Khost in a small town. It was called Ali Dawa. And he was working with the United States in the Afghan army, but while he was away, somehow bad information was given to U.S. troops, and they believed that his home was one that which should be raided and attacked. And when the U.S. soldiers did what they were trained to do in places like Fort McCoy or in Irving, California, they train and model villages. You kick in the door, you go in with dogs, you have your guns aimed, and if anybody resists in any fashion, then you hogtie them and you take them away for interrogation. Well, in this instance, the family members were so terrified that they ran up to the rooftop. Well, when they burst out onto the rooftop, on the opposite roof were other soldiers who were under instructions, and they opened fire and they killed General Khan's wife and his brother, and also his 17-year-old daughter, Nadja, his 15-year-old son, Aimal. And then his cousin, who was 9 months pregnant, heard the racket, and she came running down the street, and soldiers opened fire on her, and the baby in her womb was riddled with bullets. Well, when the U.S. military commander realized that this terrible, terrible tragedy had occurred, he, of course, had to write the letter to the general, the letter of apology. And, you know, he said, we're sorry, we're so very sorry. And I believe, you know, certainly there's a great deal of sorrow that's felt by people on the ground. But we need to feel that sorrow here, to recognize that we are a nation at war, that there are people every day who are bereaved, whose lives are forever altered, who are maimed, their children are sometimes dismembered by drone airplanes that fly in the sky and don't even have a pilot in them. When the drones attack, you know, one friend told me that they try as best they can to get the survivors and carry them bleeding and wounded to the roadside and flag a car down. But in one case, this friend told me that the car sped up. The driver tried to get away as fast as he could when he heard what had happened because he thought he might be the next target. Because these drones are still flying in the sky. And I mean, I was in Gaza in January of 2009, and the Operation Cast Lead was going on. And when you hear those drones flying overhead, you think, wow, you know, they're really mapping out a target. Maybe it's us. Maybe it's tonight.
Tell us more about your work in Gaza.
Well, I think there are many people now across the United States who are aware that Gaza has been under siege, and that for 22 days last year in 2009, and beginning December 27th, but lasting for 22 days, the Israeli Air Force pounded Gaza. When I was there, a bomb exploded once every 11 minutes at night, from 11 at night till 1 in the morning, and then there was a lull, and then it started up again from 1 until 3 a.m. You hear this, you know, crashing explosion or a sickening thud. And even I could begin to tell, well, that was probably an Apache helicopter firing a Hellfire missile, and that was a 500-pound bomb being dropped by maybe an F-15 or an F-16 airplane. And people had nowhere to go, nowhere to flee. Gaza's kind of like one big prison. And one thing I thought of is, you know, that many people would say, well, you know, the people in Gaza were importing weapons through tunnels, and I don't have any proof of that one way or the other, but I wouldn't be surprised. There were 1,300 tunnels, and it's through tunneling that all the goods that go into the marketplace are generally delivered, and it costs a great deal of money, and it's a kind of a demeaning way to, you know, burrow through the ground to try to get things in. But as I say, Gaza's been under a very tight siege that the Israelis have imposed. But one thing I think of is, if you were to build a tunnel, and only through that tunnel could the United States weapons that go to Israel be delivered, that tunnel would have to be the size of the Grand Canyon. I mean, the United States every year is equipping Israel. I mean, Israel already has 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons that they don't acknowledge, so there's no weapon inspection in terms of their nuclear arms. But they also get from the United States D-9 bulldozers to knock down houses and uproot crops. They get huge helicopters that are weaponized, and they get F-16 aircraft, and they get the 500-pound bombs and the joint defense ammunition kits and many, many cluster bombs. And all of these weapons are, you know, part of the expenditure that the U.S. has to make. Just between 2007 to 2017, the U.S. is committed to spend $30 billion for military procurements. And Israel buys some of that military material from U.S. companies, but then that makes us more and more dependent on defense spending in order to maintain our economy.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly. Many people who voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and who were delighted when he won voted partially for reasons of precisely the issues you're talking about, overspending on war, overemphasis on war. How is President Obama doing?
On the campaign trail, President Obama said there would be an uptick in military spending under an Obama administration, and that he would fight the war in Afghanistan and try to win that war. I think he thought, when he talked of a dumb war, that Iraq was a dumb war, and you got the impression that maybe the thought was that Afghanistan would be a smart war. And so I think we can't fantasize about the president that we have. I think he's more thoughtful than other presidential candidates would have been, and that's valuable. But I don't see that he's educating the U.S. public to better understand, for instance, what we're facing in Afghanistan. You don't hear him explaining that there are, you know, 10,000 villages in Afghanistan, and that even according to General David Petraeus's counterinsurgency manual that Petraeus helped write, if you're going to wage an effective counterinsurgency campaign, you're supposed to have, for every 1,000 residents of a country, 25 soldiers. Well, that would mean you'd need 600,000 soldiers in Afghanistan. So why is the U.S. fighting in Afghanistan? We're obviously not trying to wage a counterinsurgency campaign effectively, one that would, you know, end at any time soon. If we're short 500,000 soldiers, we're, you know, at the most they're only going to have 100,000. What's the point? And I think, you know, the president could be much more transparent, maybe acknowledge that the United States is already in a cold war with China over control of pricing and flow of resources. And maybe it would be time to educate the U.S. public to say, you know, maybe we need to start using our scientists to create alternative sources of energy, wind energy and water energy, and begin to really redesign our lifestyles so that we're not so dependent on car culture, so that we really can become a country that would be beloved all around the world because we'd be trying to share our resources with other people and become experts in water purification and solving problems with water scarcity and disease. I think the American public would give President Obama a great deal of support if he moved in that direction. But instead, we're told to be afraid. Be afraid because the bad guys, you know, whether it's Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, might come after you. Well, this is silly. I mean, Barbara Boxer said in December that there are less than 100 Al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan. Less than 100. And if we want to better understand who are the Taliban groups. A lot of times these are young men who can't get a job. They don't have a very good education or maybe are illiterate. They want to maybe have some adventure in life, feel like they're serving the needs of their community, and they're maybe even told by their family, you know, we don't want to be in a hock to the money lender or the landlord or the corrupt courts that don't serve us. And maybe some of these groups that say that they have the answer, maybe they're right. Well, that's all related to poverty. And if the United States insists, as George W. Bush did, that money that we gave to Pakistan, for instance, under the years when Pervez Musharraf was the dictator, had to go toward military expenditures. We gave $11.9 billion over an eight-year period to Pakistan, and $8 billion of it was spent on the military. Then we're not solving problems of poverty. And I think President Obama is a very smart man and cares deeply about the future for next generations, but we're already $1.5 trillion in debt to China and Japan, much of it because of our bloated defense expenditures and our military budget that's like a demonic suction cup. And the new budget has us spending $2 billion a day on the war. And it's going to mean $1.6 billion more dollars of debt. So this means that the children's children are the ones that are going to have to pay for all of this military spending. And for what? What does it get us? There's much more death and destruction caused by fatalities on the highway or by people's addictions to alcohol or smoking or, things that have happened here in the United States because of hurricanes and things that, you know, are unpredictable. But, you know, how many people in the United States have been killed by terrorist acts that it would warrant spending $2 billion a day on this global war on terror?
Kathy Kelly is a peace and justice activist. She's co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness and Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And once again, she will be here tonight at 7 o'clock here in Santa Fe, sponsored by Pax Christi and Veterans for Peace. And she will be at the Unitarian Church on Barcelona Street in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. And let's get you back on the radio again soon.
Oh, well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. I hope your listeners can both come tonight, maybe also check out our Peaceable Assembly campaign. That's what we see as the answer, the Peaceable Assembly campaign at vcnv.org.
vcnv.org. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.